Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 26th of February 2012. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Phil from the West End Whingers, Web Cowgirl, Gareth James, and Johnny Fox. We're now going to talk about Bingo at the Young Vic. This is a new production of Edward Bond's 1973 play concerning the last year of Shakespeare's life. It stars Patrick Stewart as Shakespeare, and the cast also includes people like Matthew Marsh, Richard McCabe, John McHenry, and Catherine Cusack. It's a rather odd play. I think Edward Bond is really rather more interested in a land deal that Shakespeare did in this, which we see depicted in this play, where local landowners were enclosing their land, and Shakespeare agreed to go along with it to guarantee that he still got his rents from his land. And that's really what it's about. You don't get an awful lot of the sort of the great playwright or the great poet here. He's actually, most of the time, almost incoherent. There's quite a big speech about bear baiting, but quite a lot of the time it's a very odd play that he's doing. I think that Edward Bond, I mean, almost certainly is much more interested in the political side of it, and it's interesting from that point of view. He paints a rather interesting picture of early 17th century life in Stratford-upon-Avon, the way that the common people were being oppressed by the ruthless landowners, I think, is his main interest, and he's just including Shakespeare because it's a good hook. It's a bit odd that this play is on, because I'm not sure that it's a really wonderful play. I mean, it's decent. This production is very well acted, and it's very it's nicely directed. But I didn't really think that it was, other than the historical interest, it's that interesting as a play in itself, and it doesn't really get you anywhere. Now, Phil, I understand you saw the first half of this, but a bottle of wine perhaps was more interesting for the in the second half.
I think anything would have been more interesting after that. I haven't been so wanting to leave a play for a long time, and it's funny, it hit me quite early on. Sorry. The first problem I had was, and obviously only seeing the first act, and I know that there are some things in the second act where Shakespeare has a drinking scene with Ben Jonson, which is supposed to be the highlight of the play, where it sort of takes off a little bit. But is that I felt in Act One, I know it's you know, the period and everything, it could almost have been about anybody rather than Shakespeare. As you say, there was the sort of the hook of the land enclosures deal, but there's really very little reference to the fact of Shakespeare. And who knew that Shakespeare could be such a dull person? He sort of seems quite introverted and sort of stymied bit by the whole thing. And I thought, well, it could be anybody from that period, which sort of, in a way, started to lose my attention quite early on. I didn't find the dialogue very interesting. It seemed completely humourless, despite a few people sort of chattering away in the auditorium, but you always get that, people desperate to sort of be entertained. And I'm afraid by the time we got to scene three, when, and this is a bit of a spoiler, but the beggar woman is hanging from a gibbet at the back of the stage, that's so remarkably realised that I just found myself staring at this, I didn't know at first whether it was the actress or a dummy, because it's so lifelike and looks so much like the actress who was playing the beggar woman earlier, that I just became mesmerized at her apparent breath control, although there was no movement at all, and we can only assume it was a dummy. But I just thought, wow, there's something actually to interest me at last. And I looked at Andrew, who was sitting next to me. He was sat there, almost as still as the dummy, just staring at this dummy at the back of the stage. That's how bad it was, that we were really looking for something to kind of hang on to, just to get through to the interval. I thought it was this idea that Shakespeare was kind of a bit of a shit, was only interested in himself, seemed kind of rather weak and kind of a bit, and a bit of an assumption, really. Edward Bond's, I think, was a Marxist writer, and you just sort of thought, get over yourself.
Yeah, there was a slight feeling that he was trying to, you know, get you leaving the theatre, hating the toffs and the landowners.
Yeah.
Well, Calgo, what did you think?
I personally left the theatre hating Edward Bond. I wasted my time. I wasn't as smart as you were. In fact, I was somewhat stuck because I'd invited somebody to this, and God forbid she was enjoying herself. Turns out somebody she knew was one of the most minor of the characters in it, so she was thrilled to actually see her in action. But I have rarely longed so much to have been with someone that I could have just said, you know, don't you think we'd be having a better time doing anything else but this? But I was really aggravated by the use of modern language and modern sensibilities in this play, and it was just as completely wrong in every way as Conor McPherson's The Veil. When you hear these people talking wearing these wonderful, completely period-appropriate costumes, and the things coming out of their mouths are modern thoughts expressed in modern ways. So I didn't believe I was listening to Shakespeare or Shakespeare's daughter or Shakespeare's neighbor. I was listening to a bunch of modern people talking about some things that happened a long time ago, but in the way that modern people speak and with modern. And so I didn't want to listen to them talk. I didn't want to get a lecture about the specifics of the Enclosure Act and the effects that it had on people. You know, to be honest, we covered this in uni. Thank you very much. And I wanted to see an excellent play with excellent performances, which we got, but done in an interesting way. And it's true, the scene with Shakespeare and Ben Jonson is actually the highlight of the play, but to be honest, I believe this is a single scene play which was fleshed out with a bunch of other hoo-ha in order to make it into a full night performance. And it was a tremendous waste of time. It's really sad, but it's true that the dead person was the most interesting character in the entire play. And it's supposed to be a play about Shakespeare, for God's sake. Someone who can talk. And even if he's got writer's block, shouldn't he have something more interesting to say than talking about snowball fights? So this was profoundly disappointing. It wasn't actually so stunningly wretched that it actually can earn points for its spectacular flopness. It was just a real waste of an evening, a real waste of talent, and I hope to God that I never see this play done again. Well, I certainly won't see it because I won't go.
I think the dummy had more life than Shakespeare himself. I've got no feeling of the fact that Shakespeare could have even written a play, let alone a good one. And I'm surprised because Patrick Stewart, I like Patrick Stewart a lot. And I'm surprised he keeps coming back to this because apparently he did it at the Donmar quite a long time ago. I don't know if it was 70s or 80s. He would have been quite young then to do it. And he did it. This is a transfer from Chichester. I'm really surprised he keeps coming back to that because it's not a part really to show any kind of thing off in terms of acting. I felt he's quite repressed in it to the point where you just have no interest in him.
Yeah, so it's a tremendous waste of his talent because there was some scene, and it wasn't talking about bull baiting, but in the second half, in the snowball scene, where he's sort of wrestling with his self-doubt and starts using some really poetic language. And I think, okay, now we're getting it. Come on, all right, you know, rock it. And then that was it. And I still had another 45 minutes to sit through and stuck. Damn it. Anyway, I wish I'd gone with you. I wish I'd left with you.
We weren't the only ones. Left.
Well, I would have thought that this show would have been sold out the night that I saw it, and there was actually like probably a good 20 seats open. We didn't have any leavers. When my friend was talking to her actress friend after the show, she said that they'd actually made the show a bit funnier than it had been, but also asked us if we had understood it, because she said they had had to change the play a bit somehow in order to make it easier for people to understand. And I wonder if they have confused boredom with not getting it, because I completely understood what they were talking about. And what is up with having an American actor there talking in an American accent? You know, I don't think America had barely been discovered when this play was supposed to be happening. And yet they've got an American on stage going on about, you know, subdividing property and all this other crap in an American accent. And I was, oh, every time he spoke, it was like fingernails going down a chalkboard.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure that Matthew Marsh, who is the actor you're talking about, is American. I'm fairly sure he's British. I'll have to check that one out.
No, there's an American actor. Because I went up and I asked them, I'm like, so who's the American actor? And they told me who it was.
It was Matthew Marsh, wasn't it?
I have no idea. It was the landlord guy.
Yeah.
Was
Matthew Marsh, yeah.
He's English.
I'm sorry, was he not speaking an American accent?
He probably was, but he was English. He's English.
I didn't notice an American accent.
He does. I mean, he does put on an American accent, and actually, he's yes. Thinking about it, reminded me a lot. He appeared in a Red Dwarf episode called Hollow Ship, and he spoke in an American accent in that, and he spoke a lot like that. He does do a fair bit of American stuff.
Yeah, he was the judge in what was it, the Monty Python play at Hampstead? What was it called? No Naughty Bits.
Yeah.
And so he absolutely stole the show.
Yeah, he's, I mean, he does quite a lot of things, but he is English. I mean, it was a bit odd. I do agree with you. His accent was a bit odd.
I just assumed that because American actors are so much worse at accents than English people did, that they did sort of a nation-blind casting and picked someone who wasn't competent enough to put on an English accent. But no, then anyone who's sitting around talking to their father about their emotional trauma, about not being as interesting as their friends in London, which I can't imagine anybody, you know, saying in England of that time, especially a dependent daughter, you know, frankly, in an American accent, you know, maybe that just made sense in context. It was horrible.
Let's talk about the hedge clipping. There was a lot of hedge clipping at the beginning, which sort of livened up the dull debate going on in front of it.
You're being weirdo.
There was quite a lot of theatre in some of the odd bits, you know, things like the hedge clipping, and in the bit in, you know, the people sweeping up leaves and earth in the interval, which you would have missed, Phil. But
there was a lot of bark, which actually when they swept it over the stage, because it was neatly piled for the first scene, and it was swept, there was a really lovely barky smell coming from it, which I quite liked. I mean, that's how desperate I was to find things I liked about this.
On the time you do the thing, I went a very early preview, possibly the first preview, and the lights, they hadn't quite worked out that people aren't going to clap unless there's a lighting change. And it was about 30 seconds between the end of the scene and people realizing that the scene had actually ended, and they were waiting for
some,
this was the end of the first act.
Oh right, okay.
I was wondering if that happened or whether they got a lighting change in just enough to show you that the first act had ended.
People clapped. I think just relief, really.
I did notice certainly what I thought was interesting was the parallels between the problems with modern condemn England and how they view the problems of the poor as all being essentially their own fault, and you know, the play's assertion that, you know, basically the people who've got the money are setting it up to screw the poor over a little bit better, while also selling the idea that it's their fault. But on the other hand, you know, it's not like this is necessarily an idea that was happening during Shakespeare's time. We were listening to a modern playwright's words about modern society, which, you know, he wished to affect a modern audience. And it would have been much more interesting if he'd actually tried to do something that was really based in the reality and the language of the times.
We're now going to talk about Patience at the Union Theatre. This is another one of Sasha Reagan's, who's a producer, her all-male Gilbert and Sullivan's, which she does pretty much every year now. Gareth, tell me more about this musical, because I'm not sure I know that much about it, and other than a satire on the British aesthetic movement.
Well, that's probably all there is to say about it, really. It's one of their lesser known actors, I suppose, and it is a satire on the aesthetic movement. So it concerns two men who court the same milkmaid, and there is a bunch of dragoon guards who are seeking to get themselves a lady. And then a bunch of ladies and maidens who are swooning and pouting over these two aesthetes, Bunthorne and Grosvenor. I think the reason it works for me is because this is, of all the Gilbert and Sullivan operettas, this is the one that lends itself to the all-male concept more than any other. And though I saw The Mikado and The Pirates of Penzance and Iolanthe and enjoyed all of them, I kind of thought that it was about to run out of steam as a concept. But I went to see it, and actually it's, the best of the four. And I think the reason it's the best of the four is predominantly the suitability of the material, but also, I think, an inspired design concept from Kingsley Hall, and just a complete set of fabulous performances. So I just think it's just a huge treat. I smiled from the minute that the lights went down to the minute I left the theatre. It's not a great score, but it just kind of sweeps you away. And I just thought it was completely blissful, really. So absolute treat for me. And I'll be talking about it, I suspect, in months, if not years to come.
I 100% support your take on it. It was an evening of pure pleasure, and given that I'd just gone to see Bingo up the street for just a few dollars more the night before, I needed one of those sort of cleansing, uplifting experiences where I was like, oh yes, theater really can be magical. And there was the day that I saw it, during as they rolled these three tables in, the legs of one of the tables collapsed as one of the lovesick maidens sat down on it, sending the teapot on top flying and shattering right in the middle of the stage. They didn't lose a beat. They did lose a table. They carried on singing. And later, when they were using the teapots that were left to pour imaginary tea, the lid of one of the teapots went flying and a dragoon guard caught it in midair. It was, and none of them lost it, even though they had to roll around on the floor a little bit in between all the porcelain shards. And just the focus that these guys had, I was completely lost in the moment as well. And you are right about the stagecraft. The thing that Sasha can do with jam jars with candles in it is completely amazing. I was in this show 8 years ago, and just the difference between the freshness of her approach and, you know, the stodgy, old, realistic way that we did it, you know, all the costumes completely accurate down to the last bit. They did songs that, you know, when I saw them performed, were boring and made them come to life. Because there's one in which the Dragoon Guards decide to try to become like the poets in order to pull the girls. And they dress up as aesthetics and stand around and do little aesthetic poses on stage. And I was just falling over. They were so, so funny. And I don't think that this trope of using the men to do the performances has run its course, because I felt this was a funnier performance of the show than I even thought possible. In fact, when we came to the final scene, I found myself appreciating the music that they were using more, and the way that they were reusing some of the choreography to emphasize some of the things that had happened earlier in the show was just fantastic. And I think it's going to wind up being it's going to be in my top five for the year, and I'm trying to get a ticket to go back and see it again.
John.
Well, I don't mean to be the wasp at the picnic, but whilst I really did enjoy the entire stagecraft of it, there are some superb singing performances. There's a young Northern Irish lad called Stephen O'Doherty, who plays Grosvenor, who has one of the most beautiful lyric baritones that you're going to come across. Really, really outstanding. And a lot of the boys singing as girls sing effortlessly from their chest voice instead of resorting to falsetto, as they did quite a lot in Iolanthe. I think this has moved on a little bit in the franchise, and you know, it's fortunate that there's another dozen as yet performed at the Union Gilbert and Sullivan's for Sasha to get her teeth into, because I think she'll probably be obliged by public demand to do the entire canon. What I didn't think worked, and here I'm disagreeing slightly with Gareth, that I didn't think it was the best motivation for doing an all-male version. I got it in Pirates of Penzance, because you've got the posturing and the machismo of the pirates and the Dolly Little Maidens, and it was very, very funny and very unusual to have them all played by all men. The difference between the Dragoons and the 20 Lovesick Maidens, I didn't feel that it necessarily needed the androgyny, although it's done very well, and it is again interesting that they have moved on slightly. This is a cast which recycled from previous productions. I could only find two names that I recognised from, say, Iolanthe. Sasha and the casting director is also the assistant director. I think he's called Adam Lewis Ford. And he's been really resourceful in finding not just new men who can do this, but hairier ones. Did anybody notice that? That the fairies in Iolanthe were quite smooth and very girlish boys. And in this production of Patience, they are very much more manly in their presentation, both as themselves and as women. And I really liked that. I thought that it was a bit of novelty that she's managed to introduce to extend the franchise yet again and bring something fresh to it. But I don't think that Patience is the greatest Gilbert and Sullivan. You from this production, there aren't tunes you can take away. You come out humming the Cardigans and the Knitting Wool and the Teapots. But I did think that whole thing was very wonderfully orchestrated, all the movement. And you can't really call it choreography because there's not great at dancing. But Drew McConey, who is the choreographer, I think has shown genius, really, in the way he managed to orchestrate all the different interchanges of movements and props, very, very heavily prop-driven production, to deliberately suit the sort of patter songs and the way the lyrics are constructed. So you never lost a lyric because somebody was concentrating on a move.
I think, I mean, going back to the choreography, I mean, I think where he succeeds really is that these maidens kind of glide along the stage, almost as if it's sort of an animal and they're all joined together. I mean, it's just absolutely gorgeous. And I think we have to say something about the MD, Richard Bates, because he plays this entire heroically on his own on a piano, and he even dons a frock so that he doesn't look out of place. I thought that was just a terrific achievement to do that, as indeed they have with all the others.
Is it harder to play in a frock than in a suit?
Well, no, I just think he might have just felt as if he was on show a little bit. That's all. I was
We're now going to talk about In Basildon. This is a new play at the Royal Court by David Eldridge. Possibly, I think it's going to be his most successful play. I think it's his most critically acclaimed play, certainly amongst his plays that haven't been adaptations, because his adaptation Feston a few years ago was very, very popular. But I think this might be one of his... it could turn into one of his popular plays. As you can see from that, it's been fairly well reviewed. It's essentially a family gathering on the death of Len, who is the sort of head of the family, although it's the family is him and his two sisters, Maureen and Doreen. And they've not been speaking for almost 20 years. And it's got to do with the house they live in and the inheritance that they are hoping to get out of it or not hoping to get out of it. There's been some disagreement about the exact ownership of the house they live in. And this is all set in Basildon. They're a family that has come to Basildon from Hackney, from the East End, and in many ways it mirrors David Eldridge's life, and he's on very familiar territory here, and I think that's something that really helps this play. In Not of the Heart, he wasn't quite so... you didn't feel he was quite so comfortable with the material, but here he's comfortable with the material, so the characters really fizz, and really you get some excellent, not only the characters, but the performances out of it. Right, we've got Linda Bassett as Doreen and Roisin as Maureen, who are excellent. You've got as Peter White as Ken, who is Len's best friend, Ken and Len again, and a great supporting cast, including Wendy Nottingham and Lee Ross and Debbie Chazen. Really bringing out what is a pretty good play. I mean, I had some slight problems with it, which I might get to later, but John, what do you reckon on this?
I was absolutely blown away by it. I think it's structurally his best piece. The last thing of his I saw, I think, was A Thousand Stars Explode in the Sky at the Lyric Hammersmith, which was a collaborative work with him and two other playwrights. And really, if I have a message for David Eldridge, is you're better on your own, mate. It really is. This is the play on which I think his career will turn. It's extremely funny. It's been given, I think, the best possible production. I think Dominic Cook has really brought the skill and quality he brought to Clybourne Park to a British homegrown play, and it's all the better for it. And I also want to bow down and worship at the twin temples of Ruth Sheen and Linda Bassett. These are two performances of downtrodden East End women who still have an inner resilience despite everything that's happened to them, that are almost documentary in their brilliance. You almost forget that these are people performing a part on stage because they are so entirely credible and entirely advisable. But the whole cast is fantastic. Debbie Chazen as the overweight daughter-in-law is also fantastic, and the I'm afraid I can't remember his name, the young man who plays the posh boy, who is
Max Bennett.
Max Bennett, who plays the posh boy introduced as a kind of cat among this East End pigeon loft, to introduce some social commentary and class differentiation so that he can be an observer of how they are, if you like, and present his own half-baked ideas about what working-class people want or need, which is also the serious message behind the play. But basically, I just thought it was tremendous casting and tremendously strong and credible performances and very, very funny. I mean, we can rave about it, but I believe it's sold out for the rest of the run, so I think anybody who's listening to us is going to have difficulty getting in.
Yeah, I saw a tweet actually earlier today from David Eldridge, because I follow him stalker-like, and he said he compared Max Bennett's Tom character, the posh boy who lectures people. Compared him to Constantine, presumably Constantine in The Seagull. And I have seen one or two other people talk in Chekhovian terms about this play.
That's very interesting that you think the influence is Chekhovian, because I mean, for me, the influence, and I believe it to be true, that David Eldridge's big hero is John Osborne. In fact, you know, if he'd set this play 12 miles to the northwest, it really would have been Look Back in Ongar. Because... Thank you. I'm here all week. because it is so very kitchen sink updated.
Now, Gareth, you didn't like his previous play, Not of the Heart at the Almeida. In fact, I think it was your worst play of last year. So this is a bit of a change, isn't it?
It was my turkey of the year. The reason I laughed to Look Back in Ongar was because I worked in Ongar for a long time. Sorry. Yes, it was my turkey of the year. And the contrast between that and this is extraordinary, really, because that was, to me, completely and utterly implausible. And this oozes authenticity and a kind of uber-realism. I would say he's actually in Mike Lee territory. than anybody else. That's what it feels most like to me.
Do you think that's slightly because of the performers? Because Ruth Sheen is a big Mike Leigh veteran, isn't she?
Yeah, well, Ruth Sheen and Peter White are Mike Leigh veterans. And I don't know if you noticed the Abigail's Party reference in the Peter White's character says he acted in Abigail's Party. I think it's just because in terms of style, I just think it feels very Mike Leigh, really. I agree with you, it's structurally very clever. We don't incidentally find out about the reason for the food until the last act, right till the end of the play, which is very clever, I think, in terms of structure. I think it's... The reconfiguration of the theatre for me is a mistake because I don't see how it really adds that much value. I understand the reason for it is that you look down on it, which is all very well from the old circle and the new circle where I was, which, yes, it does give you a kind of bear pit quality to it, which is appropriate. But you've still got most of the old stalls and then a mirror stalls. So that
in the mirror stalls, the sight lines are appalling. And I felt it was a waste of scaffolding. I didn't see the point of that.
I couldn't see the point of reconfiguring at all. I think it would have worked perfectly well on the proscenium stage. So that's the only reservation I have about it. I think it is a very, very good play. It works on so many levels, really. You've got this very interesting and very authentic personal family story. But you've also got the kind of the story of the exodus of the East Enders, you know, from the genuine East End through to sort of inner Essex in Ilford and Romford and then further out to Basildon, and the sort of the reasons they left and the attitudes they took with them. And you've also got an interesting story of the last 30 years and how politics of the last 30 years have affected these people's attitudes and sensibilities as well, really. So it's, for me, it works on lots of levels. And it's very cleverly structured. The performances are just simply stunning. I mean, you know, Ruth Sheen, I haven't seen on stage for donkey's years, and I had just a great opportunity to see her. But, you know, Linda Bassett, who's a fave for a long time, you know, gives another one of her cracking performances. I thought Lee Ross had a hard time, really, because I think he has to convey so many emotions with lots of anger and grief and his wife, how he interacts with his wife, and I thought he did that superbly well.
Yes, that's a great Best Supporting Actress, potential. I thought, I'd only ever known him from TV, sitcom and sketch shows, because he's a regular with Catherine Tate, isn't he? And I really loved his performance. I thought it stood up very well indeed.
Well, the last thing he did on stage was a supporting performance of Birdsong, and to be quite honest, he was the best thing about Birdsong on stage last year. He was very, very good, and I think he did get some nominations in the What's On Stage, or a nomination in the whatsonstage.com and on the Olivier Awards for Best Supporting Actor for that. So I think he's an actor that we, you know, be good to see more of him, really. I love the way that Maureen's daughter's boyfriend, Tom, who's the posh kid, as we talked about, I love the way his story is kind of the others in reverse, really. You know, he's actually sort of moving down from his bank, he's rebelling against his investment banker dad, and so moving downwards from that, whereas his girlfriend is kind of moving upwards as the first Essex girl who's got to university in this particular community. But I mean, it's a cracking, nice, great piece of writing. My message to David Eldridge, which I know he's already got because there's a comment on Twitter, my message to David Eldridge is stick to what you know. And, you know, he's writing here clearly in an area he knows a lot about. And that's, for me, why it's such a good play. And that's, for me, why Knot of the Heart was just not a good play. Because
Are we calling in the East End Alan Bennett?
Well, that's not a bad... I mean, the only other thing he's done, set in the East End, I can remember, is Market Boy, which he didn't refer to. But, yeah, well, maybe. It's very funny. I mean, we talk about the play, but what we haven't mentioned is actually how funny it is at times. Particularly the sort of black humour, which was great. The one thing I'd say about the audience, though, I felt the audience around me were a bit condescending, and I felt they were kind of looking down on Essex, not just...
I wrote in my review that I thought in a Sloane Square theatre it was a made-in-Chelsea audience getting a chance to sneer at people who wouldn't make it into The Only Way Is Essex.
Yeah, I lived and worked in Essex for 19 years, and I was just a little bit offended by that, really. I felt, even though I'm a Welsh boy, not an Essex boy, I felt a bit offended on behalf of my former friends from the area. But anyway, cracking...
I'm a Mancunian, so it was all like a bit of anthropology for me. You know, you're all different tribes, as far as I'm concerned. Right. But... Are we predicting a transfer?
Well, they'd have to reconfigure. I mean, they would have to go back to proscenium art, I would imagine, but I can't see why not. I didn't realize it was selling that well, actually, but if it's selling that well, why not? I mean, you know, Clybourne Park and Jerusalem and Enron all did really well in the West End. And although the Heretics should have transferred and that didn't, so I'm not so sure. I don't know. But it'd be lovely, I think, if it did.
Oh, well, I hope it has a life beyond this fairly short run till March 24th, I think. So, yeah, good luck to it. Great.
Yeah, I would. I mean, I should mention that Lee Ross. I saw Lee Ross. I've seen him quite a few times in smaller theatres. And one of the things I saw him in was a play called Mad, which was also by David Eldridge. And again, that was probably one of the better David Eldridge plays I'd seen up to this one. And he was very good in that, and he's a rather impressive actor, actually, but he doesn't get an awful lot of credit, I think, because he's a, you know, the telly stuff and the comedy. There's also a very nice comic performance by Christian Dixon as a slightly drunken vicar, which I thought was you know, nicely played, and it's a nice little, you know, nice little almost a cameo part.
Did you? If I had a criticism, I thought that was a little bit out of tune with the rest of the play.
Yes, possibly. But
I didn't quite know what comment they were making by making him black. But
yes, I mean, I didn't see. Yes,
well,
I didn't
make him black. He was black.
Yeah.
Making the character.
No, yeah. And the only criticism I have, and it's something I have a problem with, I had a problem with it in Knot of the Heart much more than I had it here, is something David Eldridge, I'm always seeing, is very critical of the modern practice theatre managements of wanting you to constantly rewrite your play. And he's been very critical of that, and he seems to believe that, you know, he doesn't like to keep redrafting and finessing the play, which a lot of people do. And there are occasions, and it's only a few occasions in this play, but much more in Knot of the Heart, where you get this idea that the character has just been given these lines to read. And it's in context. It's right. It's as if it's almost placeholder text. And there were just a couple of times, because I was looking for it, because it was much more evident. I felt it was much more evident in Knot of the Heart, where you got this kind of almost placeholder dialogue. It's right. It's in context, but it's not quite in character. It's sort of and it comes across, and you might say, well, that's a stylistic thing because it makes him come across as very blunt and very honest. But because it hasn't put any sort of finesse, any character finesse on it, they're not trying to hide anything or play lots of, you know, with lots of, say, writerly tricks. And that's just a slight thing, and that's because of something like Knot of the Heart, where I noticed it much more, and I think that's one of the things I didn't like about that play. I was actually on the lookout for it here, and it did the one or two lines where it's sort of slightly jarred, but that's almost my only criticism on the on this night, because as you say, it is the best David Eldridge I've seen. I've seen a lot of his plays, and I hope it gets a West End transfer, and I hope it's really, you know, lots of other people enjoy it, really.
Can I just add one thing? It's not even the end of February yet, and I now have two candidates for my best performance by a corpse later this year, because Phil Cornwell in this, as was the lad whose name escapes me, a Lucky Stiff at the Landor a few weeks back. Phil Cornwell is brilliant, and I was looking down, so I was really kind of staring down into this coffin, and he was really terrific as a corpse. Sorry.
Okay, we're now going to talk about Hay Fever by Noel Coward. This is just opened at the Noel Coward Theatre. This is Noel Coward's 1924 play about a terrible family called the Blisses, and who each invite a victim almost to a weekend in their rambling house in Cookham, I think it is.
Cookham, yes.
Yeah, and they are pretty awful and horrible throughout it. And the trick with this play, of course, I think, is to make sure that although you think these are terrible people, that you actually get that you actually want to spend time watching them. I don't think you want to spend time in their presence necessarily, but you want to watch them. And I think this production, which stars Lindsay Duncan as Judith Bliss, Jeremy Northam, Kevin McNally, Olivia Colman, amongst other people, is pretty good at it. Not the best one I've seen. Now, you have quite a bit of history, John, with this play.
First of all, it's Noel Coward's favourite play among his own writings. And I think it's my favourite Noel Coward play. It's superbly constructed. And I think that the 84, 86-year-old script, whatever it is, comes up incredibly fresh. It's astonishing that something as old as that should need no tinkering with for a modern audience. But I first saw this in 1972. I was a student at the Grand Theatre Leeds with husband and wife Michael Denison and Dulcie Gray, the absolute epitome of English acting coupledom. And it's interesting how many other English acting couples have had a crack at Judith Bliss and her husband David over the years. I think one of the best I saw was Mariah Aiken and John Standing at the Albury in 92. But it's been done many, many times. And I think the success of it is the more actressy the woman playing Judith Bliss is, the better the production will be. Judy Dench had a very, very good crack at it I think it must have been the Haymarket, because she doesn't seem to play anywhere else, a few years ago, which was also quite strong. But Lindsay Duncan confessed that she'd never seen the play. And I wonder if this came through in her performance. It's an interesting reading. She is much more physically strong than most of the people who are playing this retired actress, and she strides around rather more, and her dominance of the proceedings is more physical than with her voice, which I felt was a bit quiet. Certainly didn't carry to the back of the stalls on all occasions, and that applies to a lot of the cast. It is a little bit underpowered as a production. Did you find that?
Well, certainly it had difficulty sort of raising the laughs at first, and I didn't actually hear an awful lot of noise from behind me. I was about four rows back, so I didn't entirely, you know, I couldn't hear anybody at the back. So perhaps they weren't, they weren't hearing as much as we were. I mean, they were fairly warm in it, but it was almost that it felt as if they were pretty silent when things were going on, so perhaps they were, you know, straining to listen to the play. I mean, this is, yeah, I agree with you about the actorly thing. I think one of the better ones I saw was actually Stephanie Beecham in a touring production of this play, where she was extremely actorly, and it's almost as if you need somebody from an overblown American soap opera, because that's the kind of plays that Judith Bliss was doing. You know, where you have the sort of,
yeah, she was doing melodrama
things, melodramas, yes. And it's exactly that right kind of thing. Now, what did you? I was actually quite impressed by the two children who have to sort of carry the play from the start, Freddie Fox and Phoebe Waller-Bridge. What did you think of those two actors?
Well, I'm slightly in love with Dan Stevens, who played Simon Bliss in the Judy Dench production, and I thought he was absolutely perfect because he could do the comic timing, but he also had that sort of natural suavité and natural good manners. I know this is a play about not having good manners, but natural good breeding, if you like, that underpinned his raffish and slightly bad boy behaviour. I'm not sure Freddie Fox had quite the pedigree to do that. He is beautiful to look at, and just I thought he was too camp and a little bit too childish.
This yes, is the he wasn't young... forceful, was he? Yeah.
No, this is the youngest Simon and Sorrel that I've ever seen play the two parts, and because each of them has lured an older lover down to the house in Cookham, Simon has chosen a vamp and sophisticated society lady. And Sorrel has snared a diplomatist, you know, a man from the embassy kind of thing. And it looked a little bit indecent that Freddie Fox was having a liaison with a woman played in her 50s, or perhaps That wasn't really Olivia Colman's intention, because she is woefully miscast. But in playing against an older woman lover like that. So not perfect casting, and you're quite right. They do kick off the first scene, and that's your first engagement with the bohemianism of the Bliss family. And I don't think they really captured it quite strongly enough. You have to hit it a bit harder than that at the opening of this particular play. But I did see quite an early preview, and this may well improve. And I think the sound issue may also improve. I think in that theatre, you know, it's a very large theatre, four tiers. It needs miking, which I don't normally like for stage plays, but I would almost recommend it. For another reason, that Coward is written in very long sentences and quite long lines. It's not all snappish, six words each, banter. People deliver quite substantial speeches, and you almost need the kind of breath control you need for Shakespeare in order to deliver it. So that's why, again, Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, those sorts of people are extremely good at delivering this sort of material. And I think a lot of modern actors don't necessarily have the lung power to do that acoustically and project in a big theatre and still deliver the subtlety. So I think miking might have helped this production.
Okay, I have to say the first time I remember this, my history with this play was first production was Geraldine McEwan, the production done by Declan Donlan at the Savoy Theatre in the late 90s, which I regretted because I persuaded a whole lot of people to go to this based on the strength of the cast, and unfortunately. That production was done almost gothically, you know, as if it was some kind of gothic melodrama, and they lost every single joke, I think.
Yeah.
This one at least acknowledges that it's supposed to be funny. Although I think, and that's the thing here, you know, although it might be complex to speak about, Hay Fever is supposed to be funny, and you should be laughing almost from the start.
Yes,
about from this, and you should be having a good time. And although it took a long time for people to warm up on this play, and I didn't feel the love all the time. Although I thought it was a decent production, but I don't know about a great production.
A decent production. That's a fair thing to say about it. And if you caught it at Harrogate or Windsor or Edinburgh or something, you probably think it was all right for the provinces, but this is a West End production. This is in the Noel Coward Theatre. This has had a great deal of trumpeting, and I do think it's not quite as good as the opportunity given to it. There are two older male characters played by Jeremy Northam and Kevin R. McNally. David Bliss, Judith's husband, is Kevin McNally, and Richard Gretham, the diplomatist who flirts with the daughter, Sorrel, played by Jeremy Northam. I thought they could have been transposed. I thought Jeremy Northam would have been a much better and more appealing and easier to warm to David Bliss. I found McNally a little bit lumpen and a little bit unconvincing as a very successful novelist who understands the mind of women so brilliantly, which is part of his characterization. And the rest of the cast were also a bit secondary. So it'll be interesting to see what print critics say about it, because I think we're still in preview at the moment.
Yeah, the critics will come out on Monday.
This is one of the complicated ones, isn't it, where there are several press nights.
Yes, they've all seen it and promised to be quiet about it. Yes, I think. They've been embargoed.
Interesting, because we'll get quite considered reviews. People will have had a couple of days to stew over what they think about it, rather than, like us, being obliged to come almost directly from the theatre to the microphone and talk. So, yes, I'd be very interested to see the reviews when they come up, but I don't think they're going to be universally good. I also found the set rather strange. You know, this is a country house. It's very, very clearly delineated in the play that it's a country house in Cookham, obviously a substantial one. You can sleep eight people for the weekend. And we appear to be in a garage. It's almost like it's a painter's studio or something like that, rather than a comfortable country house. I didn't quite get the transposition of it to this kind of atelier setting. What did you think about that?
It was a little bit odd, but I didn't. It didn't bother me that much. But yes, certainly it was sort of taking a bit of bohemianness a bit too much, because they did, as you say, seem to be in some kind of painter's studio all the time. And I think they were taking that idea a bit too much. And also that it was very, you know, the everything was a bit broken down, and they are actually very affluent, these people.
Yes, Judith says at one point, we've enough money to keep us in comfort until we die. So, yes, they're meant to be extremely well off.
So it was a bit odd to have, you know, chairs propped up by, or chaise longues propped up by books. You can find this podcast at AYULTP on Twitter, on the As Yet Unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are ayu-londontheatre.org. And the podcast can be found on iTunes, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.